Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we're romancing an old cuisine. Our guest, Diana Henry, talks the Russian tradition of the zakuski table. This is the Russian take on hors d'oeuvre. Now you can cue Lara's theme right about here, because in the days when you traveled in open sleighs through long snowy afternoons, you'd arrive at your host's home to a grand table of little dishes to tide you over to dinner. It was called zakuski, and now it could put the cocktail party out to pasture.
A zakuski can either just be the starter for a meal, little dishes which form the starter, or it can be the whole meal.
So you can make a party out of this fairly easily.
Absolutely. You just need plenty of vodka. Or champagne, should you be so inclined.
British food columnist Diana Henry. Zakuski, your calls, and so much more this hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This holiday season, we're partnering with Feeding America to bring help to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table now, your gift will help provide meals to people in need through our partners at Feeding America and their network of local member food banks. Learn how to help at splendidtable.org/give. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So much of what we eat these days originates from places of the sun. You know, the Mediterranean, Asia, the Middle East. It seems we can forget about the flavors of Eastern Europe, but those are the cuisines where winter foods can really shine. I mean, when was the last time you visited a smorgasbord or had a Russian zakuski party or a Polish pierogi supper? Well, British food writer Diana Henry is going to change that for us. She's the author of Roast Figs and Sugar Snow, Winter Food to Warm the Soul. Hey, Diana. Welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's lovely to be talking to you.
You know, at last, somebody is focusing on the foods that are not necessarily about ginger, garlic, and olive oil.
Well, the Mediterranean of food has been wonderful, but I think we have neglected then to look at what is on our doorstep. And I just always liked cold weather food and used to go to the Savoie every Christmas. And then I started to travel all over the place, basically, including in the States, Vermont and Massachusetts and all around there, to pick up recipes from other areas which also kind of had the same staples that we have in Britain, but maybe used them in a different way.
Well, you know, Diana, there's something that you talk about in the book that I don't think I've ever seen anyone mention in the United States. Zakuski. And it's a great... Can you explain what it is and give us a little background on it?
Well, zakuski, it's the Russian. And the word zakuski comes from little morsel. That's basically what it means. And if you think of Spanish tapas and Italian antipasti and Middle Eastern mezze, basically, zakuski are the Russian version of that. And I had never heard of them either until I was in Russia. It was before the end of communism and had pretty lousy eating, I have to say, for a week. And met someone from the British Council and he said, well, I'm going to take you to a Georgian restaurant. And we drove for miles one evening through very grey concrete blocks and I didn't know where we were going to end up. But we went in then through a plain door in a very grey building and inside this Georgian restaurant, and Russians love Georgian food, was amazing. painted walls, violin players, gypsy dancers. And of course, I couldn't recognize them, but it was full of ballet dancers and politicians and people who are very celebrated there. But it was the food that really bowled me over, because what we were served that night was zakuski. And I just thought this was kind of great, partly because they put together flavors that we wouldn't think of. The thing that I loved most on that kind of, and they just keep coming the way antipasti do, little plates of things.
Right.
They had beans with plum sauce, kidney beans. They had Georgian cheese pie, which is kind of like very flaky dough with, it's almost like a mixture of melted mozzarella and feta inside it, if you can imagine that.
Ooh, oh.
Aubergine caviar, eggplant caviar, as you would call it, which of course you also get in Turkey. So there are some kind of overlaps between the colder and warmer countries. But a zakuski can either just be, it can be the starter for a meal, little dishes which form the starter, or it can be the whole meal.
So you can make a party out of this fairly easily.
Absolutely. You just need plenty of vodka. Or champagne, should you be so inclined. It's a good mix also of things which are bought and things which are made. So if you do things like make your own beans with plum sauce and aubergine caviar, then you fill that out with the essential kind of things which are smoked fish, cured hams, right, salami, sausages. And again, there's a mixture of cold and warm here because olives are quite common on them and pickled hot peppers. But then at the same time, you have smoked salmon, which reminds you of Scandinavia. So there's a whole mixture of little dishes. Some of them are cold. Some of them are hot. Right. You can do little meatballs and things like that. And I like to kind of add, radishes are beautiful, and they're those peppery ones, the Frank's breakfast radishes. They're kind of lovely for dipping in sour cream. Sour cream dressed with dill and a little sugar and wine vinegar. Mushrooms that you've sauteed and then mixed with sour cream and dill. Or indeed, you can saute them and then leave them to marinate in dill and crushed coriander seeds and lemon. That's another kind of mushroom thing. Oh, and we mustn't forget beets. Roast beetroot. Hot or cold. And also, if you want to extend it to make a whole meal, you can cook potatoes, little waxy potatoes, and serve those warm. But the zakuski table, the table you serve it from, ideally should be round or oval, and people should be able to walk all the way around it. And on each side, the hot dishes go on one side, the cold dishes go on the other, and at each end you have little plates and napkins and little forks. But everybody is supposed to mingle, and in the middle is a very important part of it, black bread or rye bread, and sometimes I also add Middle Eastern flatbreads.
This could be pulled off rather easily and economically. I like this idea a lot. It's essentially a buffet.
It is, and quite a simple one. I did one about 2 years ago at Christmas. I think Christmas is a wonderful time to have them because it's all, you know, snow, Dr. Zhivago, all that kind of thing. And serving up tapas again or mini quiches or something that we're all kind of sick of, I thought this was really, you know, this is exotic. Even though partly you're serving hard-boiled eggs and smoked salmon, if you add to it dishes that people don't know and you take them to a new place, I mean, it's wonderful. It's great for a drinks party, and people help themselves and they just do it on small plates. You're not having to do big stews or anything like that.
Well, Diana, thank you. And happy holidays.
You too.
Diana Henry is the author of Roast Figs and Sugar Snow, Winter Food to Warm the Soul. Now, for a guide to zakuski and recipes to throw your own, head to the website, splendidtable.org. Finding a gift for a wine lover can be like those dreams where you show up at work naked. What you think you need to know can feel entirely overwhelming. Well, rescue is at hand. Imagine a white knight on his horse galloping in with a banner streaming behind, "The perfect wine for you." Our white knight is executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine, Ray Isle. Ray, welcome back.
Thanks for that. I've never been compared to a white knight before. I like that.
Hey, this is your new title. So you did a piece on classic wines. How do you define a classic wine?
Well, for me, classic wines are wines which kind of define a region or a place that are emblematic of it. So, you know, a wine that if you taste this wine, if you drink it, you'll have a real sense of, you know, what it means when someone says Oregon, you know, Willamette Valley Pinot Noir, or mm-hmm. what it means when someone mm-hmm. says, you know, Champagne. So not the kind of outliers, but the really central wines of a region.
So can you pick maybe just a handful of wines that you would say represent the classics?
Absolutely. I can pick several handfuls, in fact, but I'll hold it back to three or four. And that way we'll cover, you know, a couple of whites, a couple of reds, and get a sense of the regions around the world as well. And I would start with Champagne. I do think, you know, that there are few occasions on which Champagne is not a good thing to be opening. And, you know, Champagne technically comes from the Champagne region in France. And the one I chose for the article, which is one of my favorites as a kind of basic Brut Champagne, is the Paul Roger Brut Reserve Champagne. That's, you know, list suggested price is around $45, but mm-hmm. realistically this time of year you'll start to see deals. And I like the Paul Roger because it's so classically Champagne. It's crisp. It's got, you know, a little bit of creaminess, kind of that slightly toasty, creamy character that good Champagne has. It's still a family-owned company, which is kind of a nice, an unusual thing in the larger brands of Champagne these days. And again, it's one of those wines you pop the cork, you pour a glass, you taste it, and if you had any doubt about what Champagne was, this will, you know, this mm-hmm. this gives you mm-hmm. that sense. And then another white wine, I included a couple of classics that I think of as being new classics in a sense, and one of which is an Australian Riesling, because people tend to think of Riesling as being sweet and slightly cloying, yeah. and Australian Rieslings are dry and crisp and almost racy. They've got a real mineral kind of streak to them. And the one I picked was a Grosset Polish Hill Riesling. Jeff Grosset is one of the defining Riesling winemakers in Australia. And Polish Hill is this vineyard in Clare Valley in Australia that produces just fabulous Rieslings. And that's also in the sort of $40 range. There are a lot of more affordable, terrific Australian Rieslings too that I, you know, urge people to go out and try, because if they have the sense of Riesling as being this sweet wine, these will completely change their perspective on it. And then, you know, I thought classic doesn't necessarily have to mean expensive. In this case, one I chose is Penfold's Koonunga Hill Shiraz Cabernet, which is, to me, just definingly classic, affordable Australian red. You know, it's $12 a bottle. It's juicy. It's got a lot of blackberry spicy flavor. And it's, you know, it's perfect barbecue wine. It's perfect winter wine with stews and things mm-hmm. like that. And it's, you know, it's affordable. It's not – it doesn't claim to be a wine that's going to, you know, age for 40 years in your cellar. It's not, you know, going to overwhelm you with complexity. But it will impress you with deliciousness, which for $12 is a good thing.
Yeah. But what about the United States?
I mean, the U.S. has become – you know, an incredible wine region over the past, you know, century or so. And one of the up-and-coming regions I like is Oregon, the Willamette Valley, particularly for Pinot Noir. And Pinot Noir is very popular these days. And Oregon Pinot Noirs tend to be a little more streamlined, a little spicier than the sort of California ones. They're not to the point of Burgundy, but they're a kind of interesting mid-range between California and Burgundy. And one of the ones I like best, which I do feel is a kind of defining Oregon Pinot, is Irie Vineyards, their estate Pinot Noir. It's about $29, give or take. And David Lett, who founded Irie and who passed away, you know, last year, was one of the, you know, he planted the first Chardonnay and Pinot Noir vines in the Willamette Valley and was a hugely significant person in that wine region. And it's still a fantastic Pinot. And it's one of those nice wines that's, you know, under $30 that is delicious to drink now, but also could be put in a cellar and aged for a while. So it's a great gift as well. And that to me is kind of what I mean by classic. Again, it gives you that whole sense of what Oregon Pinot can be and is. And at the same time, you know, it's distinctive unto itself.
Oh, this sounds great. Ray, thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Ray Isle is executive wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. You can find his classic wine suggestions on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, David Chang and the remake of Cauliflower. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. David Chang is the hands and brains behind a clutch of restaurants in New York that fly under the banner Momofuku. There's Noodle Bar, there's Sam Bar, there's Milk Bar, and there's Co. Now, today they're destination eateries, but that didn't happen overnight. Chang had to battle his way through self-doubt and hang-ups about authenticity to find out that the food that he wanted to cook was much better than the food that he thought he should cook. Now people stand in line for a very long time to get a taste. Once you do get a seat, you eat things like bacon dashi with potatoes and clams, shrimp and grits, kimchi consommé, food that crosses paths with David's Korean ancestry in Japan, America, and Lord knows where else. Well, David's done a book, Momofuku. David Chang, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, David, you write in the book that one of the best-selling things at Sambar is the cauliflower with fish sauce vinaigrette. And I just wonder, how does cauliflower become a bestseller? What in heaven's name have you done to cauliflower?
I know, it's very strange. We have people eating tremendous amounts of vegetables that they avoided in their childhood. Originally, the noodle bar dish was kimchi puree with Brussels sprouts. And sometimes we would do roasted cauliflower.
Uh-huh.
And we found that these vegetables took an intense amount of pungent flavors and they married very well together. So I think it was one of those accidents, those beautiful accidents that happen in a professional kitchen.
Well, you know, you go from this, which you can see the Korean and Asian background, but then I flip around in the book and I come to a recipe that really surprised me. Straight out of Charleston, South Carolina, shrimp and grits.
Yes.
Tell me about this.
Well, in the book, it was a story of me basically stealing polenta from one of my chefs that I used to work for, whose restaurant was up the street, Marco Canora, and he had polenta, and I had cooked a lot of Anson Mills at other restaurants.
Anson Mills always, is the people who make ground corn to make grits in
beautiful,
the Carolinas.
Beautiful, beautiful stuff in from Columbia, South Carolina. And they really do mill it fresh every week. That's what makes it really special, and they have very certain heirloom strains of corn, which mm-hmm. make the grits very great. But anyways, we're eating this, and it was sort of inspired by my partner at the time, who has his own restaurant now. He was telling me how he grew up in Colombia, the country Colombia, because his parents were diplomats, and how he would eat a version of hominy with basically fried eggs on top. And we were really down and out at that time. And I was like, well, what can I do to cheer Aquino up? So that's why I went to Hearth, and I took a couple quarts of the polenta, and at the time, we only had the ramen stock. If I had chicken stock on hand, I'd make it with chicken stock.
Right.
And I mounted it with butter, and we had soy sauce on hand instead of salt. Soy and butter are a really magical combination. So we added, I mounted it with butter and soy, and that was the first version of it. And then I dropped a couple of the slow poached eggs that we have in the book and tasted it. And I was very surprised at the flavoring. And we all ate a hot and hearty bowl of that. And that was a watershed moment for the restaurant. We just sort of knew what flavor profiles in Asia we wanted to work with, and the flavor profiles from the south of the American South, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of happened.
So it's the way you made peace with fusion.
Yes. I'm embracing the word fusion. I've been a strong advocate against the word fusion. Uh-huh. I'm now pro-fusion.
It's very different when it comes about naturally rather than being superimposed on stuff.
Yes.
But, David, tell me, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Northern Virginia, right outside D.C., but my father had a business that was in Richmond, so I'd spent – and I had many family members, so I'd spend a considerable amount of my time in the Richmond area. And I think that once you hit Charlottesville, Richmond area in Virginia, then you hit – that's the proper South. Anything above that's really the D.C. area. So I never realized, like, my diet consisted of all sorts of strange things, Korean food, and then sort of Waffle House-like Southern things on the weekends. And I also played a lot of competitive golf as a child, so I would travel specifically in the South playing tournaments, and I think that left a big impression on me in terms of how I view the world and how I you know, in retrospect, view food. And mm-hmm. I never really thought about how important – obviously, everyone says childhood is very important in terms of how you view the world in the future. But it was a chef, Juan Marie Arzak, that really sort of nailed it on the head for me when he told me – and it's one of his famous sayings – you have to look at food through a child's eyes, very innocent and playful, and it's when you have no judgments and you're not jaded and you think about the origins of a dish and it comes from something that you might have had and you don't even remember it. It's stuck in your subconscious somewhere.
Well, David, there is a childlike quality to your food as I look at these recipes. The playfulness and the imagination comes through. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
David Chang is the chef and creator of the Momofuku restaurants in New York City, and he's co-author of the cookbook Momofuku. David left us with his recipe for that fried or roasted cauliflower with fish sauce vinaigrette. You can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. Guaranteed to make the earth move. Just like David Chang, Jane and Michael Stern have their own style of food, but they're not chefs, they're eaters, and road food is what they do. In fact, they've been doing it since the 1970s. The Sterns report their finds on their site, roadfood.com, and here. Hey, Jane, Michael, welcome.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. Have you ever been to Salt Lake City?
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you were there, did you go to a restaurant called The Lambs?
Remind me what it's like.
It is Utah's oldest restaurant. It's actually 90-some years old. It's hard to describe it exactly. It's kind of a coffee shop diner with white tablecloths. So
it's sort of, I mean, the term retro doesn't even wrap around it enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an ancient dining room with wonderful versions of ancient food. I mean, truly, we have not seen beef stroganoff on a menu recently.
Excuse me. Beef a la stroganoff, as it is listed there.
Right. Or Finn and Hattie. Or,
these are great dishes. Yeah, no, you're talking about nostalgia. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and beautifully whipped potatoes. I mean, it's a gem that I would say is not a hidden gem because people in Salt Lake City are very proud of this place. It is probably the oldest restaurant in the town, but it has really kept its nostalgic retro roots. And I think it was the first restaurant that Michael and I ever ate in 30 years ago when we went to Salt Lake City. We were just there 2 weeks ago and ate there again, and it was seamless. It was like time had compressed.
So the quality has been kept up through all this time, and these dishes still taste new or interesting or great or whatever?
No, they don't taste new.
They definitely don't taste new. I mean, they're fresh, but they're not new. There's nothing surprising on this menu. They actually have modernized a little bit. You can get a Cajun salad or blackened chicken breast or something like that. But the fact is, what you want to get there is, you know, a great chicken fried steak or the triple lamb chops or mountain trout with mashed potatoes on the side. I mean, it's just really good square meals type food, followed by some of the great cakes and pies you'll find anywhere. Because as you probably know, Lynn, one of the great things about Utah is its sweet tooth. And it is home of some of the best candies, cakes, and pastries you'll find anywhere.
Granted that Salt Lake is not 100% Mormon, but there is a very, very large population of Mormons throughout the state. And Mormons can't drink. Mormons cannot drink coffee, tea, or smoke. And so what's left? Candy, sugar, cakes. Mm-hmm. And boy, did they do a good job with it.
We had a five-layer chocolate cake for dessert that was just – I mean, it wasn't gourmet or fancy. It was just a great layer cake with thick, deep, dark chocolatey frosting. And I think, Jane, you had that baked apple.
Oh, my God, was that wonderful.
One thing I just have to say parenthetically is that meals are accompanied by – really fresh and really good Greek bread, you know, that stuff that's kind of eggy and very soft and spongy. I mean, wonderful.
Kind of like challah.
It's kind of like challah bread. It's the best thing ever for mopping gravy
and
off a plate.
Because the lamb's is Greek run, they also have major rice pudding for dessert with powdered cinnamon on it. It's just terrific.
I don't know how I've missed this place. I have to go.
I don't either because it's been there almost forever.
This sounds fabulous. Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the founders of roadfood.com. Find their dining picks at splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around. When it seems
it is time for us to talk. We are opening the lines to you. The number is 800-537-5252. Or get to us on Facebook or shoot us an email. SplendidTable.org. Anything goes. Okay, we have got Amber calling in from Germany. Amber.
Hello.
Hello, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. I'm really excited to be able to do this.
What are you doing over in Germany?
I'm actually working on my dissertation in philosophy. And even though I'm graduating from an American university, I'm writing the dissertation over here in Germany.
Whereabouts are you?
I'm in Marburg, which is in Hesse, or Hessen. It's about an hour and a half away from Frankfurt.
So you're in the northern part of the country, if I remember correctly.
Have I got it's kind of in the middle.
Geography was never my strong suit.
It's
what
not
can
mine
I tell
either.
You? Well, what can I do for you?
Well, I'm living in a very, very small apartment here in Marburg. And although the other rooms are reasonably good size, the kitchen is tragically small. The Germans are masters of space conservation, to be sure. But my kitchen is probably about 6 foot by 6 foot at the largest. And once you include countertop space and shelving and so on, I probably have about 4 feet to move around in.
Well, everything's handy, no doubt, right?
Well, that's true. I don't have to move around too much. The problem is I don't have an oven. And in fact, all I have to cook on are two electric burners. One of them is fairly small. The other one's reasonably large. But it leaves me with, you know, I'm fairly limited
right.
The dishes that I can prepare in this kitchen. I've gotten very handy with a frying pan. But I'm having a guest for the all-important third date over in a few days.
Yeah.
And I was hoping to be able to cook a nice meal, you know, with perhaps a couple courses or something like that. But it's so hard to time everything when all I have are two electric burners.
Okay. What does this person like?
Well,
I know
not
it's the
exactly
third
sure.
date, but have you got a sense? Have you got a sense of what this person likes?
Well, the first two dates, we always ended up, we were at the opera both times. And
Good taste.
Yeah, it worked for me. But we always ended up at a Turkish restaurant afterwards. So I know he likes the kind of Turkish Mediterranean style food.
Yeah,
but I also know he's a big fan of steak. And that's about all I know.
And you're essentially, you're on a student's budget, right?
Yes, that's right.
I think he'll get over steak. I don't know that you need to do the steak. Also, steak, you know, it's you have to watch it. It is a pain in the neck when you want to be focused on the person as opposed to making dinner. Okay, let me think for a minute. We need to have some cold food, you know, that would normally be served at room temperature so that you can have your courses. Like, for instance, I would imagine, if I recall correctly, in Germany, there's some pretty interesting smoked fish and smoked meats.
Yes, that's true.
Now, you don't need a lot, but what I'm thinking is suppose you do a salad of mash or some other wintergreen. You're going to find it in the market. It'll be in season. You can wash it and completely dry it way ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And then what you would do is you just take a little bit of good smoked fish or some smoked meat or a little bit of ham. You break that up into slivers or slice it into slivers. And then I take some kind of dried fruit, like dried tart cherries, if you could get them.
Oh, yeah.
Or little bits of prune. And then an oil and vinegar dressing. And it could be a nut oil like walnut oil, or it could be a decent wine vinegar or even a great cider vinegar. Okay,
but oh, yeah.
And don't spend a fortune, all right?
Well, it sounds great, and I know there's a market, a farmer's market that is held right across the street from me, and I know they sell smoked fish, so that would be perfect.
Yeah, and you don't need a lot. You literally need 2 ounces of this stuff. Because
sure.
And then what you do is, before he arrives, you arrange the salad, tuck the bits of smoked fish, you know, into the leaves with the bits of the dried fruit, and you have some nuts, throw some nuts over it, and then the last minute, you would put it out on the table and drizzle the dressing over it. So oil, vinegar, and if you want, a little mustard in the dressing. Now, the next thing you might want to do is how about doing something like a North African stew?
That would be great.
Wouldn't that be fabulous? You could brown some onions along with spices. The flavorings you want are things like cumin, coriander, sweet paprika, a little hot paprika, cinnamon, and then a great variety of vegetables and a little bit of meat. So you So you would do something like you could brown in your skillet a bit of lamb, you know, lamb stew meat. But you don't need a lot of it. It's a flavoring. Okay. It's not the main event. And then you'd brown onions and cut up turnips of all things and pieces of cut up potato. And you could have greens in this. You would have green beans. The more variety, the better. The more colorful, the better. And then that all goes into your soup pot. And you add some tomatoes to that. You add the spices to that. You could add some even canned broth to that. And let it simmer and taste it. You want it to have a lot of zing from the spice. And you're making a wonderful stew. And then what you do in the other pot is, do you have a second deeper pot?
I do, yes.
Do you have a strainer, like a colander?
Yes, I do.
Can it fit in the pot?
That I don't know.
You could even, you know, take a regular strainer and line it with cheesecloth. What I want you to do is get some couscous. And you're going to steam the couscous until it's fluffy over simmering water. It doesn't touch the water. It just should be in some kind of container where the steam can get to it. Put a lid on it. And you're going to fluff it every so often with a fork. And you can hold it there for quite a while. So the idea is you have this wonderful, beautiful stew of vegetables flavored with lamb and lots of interesting spices. And you serve that with the couscous. You've started out with the salad. And the dessert, I would make it fruit and some cheese or something store-bought, but very, very simple.
Oh, that sounds great, though. And it sounds like it would be a great meal.
It would be a great meal, and you make the stew the day ahead.
Yes.
So all you do is warm it up. You are there, girl.
Oh, that sounds great and manageable. Thank you so much for your help.
You take care, Amber, and I wish you good luck. Great third date.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Now, we're going to be back with more of your questions in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, we're talking to you this hour. Let's get back to your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We've got Mike on the line from Detroit. Mike, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thinking about my annual Hanukkah dinner.
Yeah?
It's kind of my year-end tradition to serve old and new friends made in the year. And anyway, I was kind of thinking it's my time to show off a little bit in the kitchen, try something new.
Of course.
And it's not a traditional Hanukkah dinner, first of all, because we're going to be serving fish. I got an idea for something a few weeks ago when I went to a restaurant and I was served a potato cake that was deep fried. Of course, potato cakes like latkes go with Hanukkah, but
right.
Anyway, we don't have to be so traditional here because I can always do those separately. But anyway, back to the potato idea. I was thinking about something that would complement the fish and the vegetables and the sauce that I'm going to serve.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking of either a potato or maybe even polenta with perhaps some black beans inside.
Would be and fabulous.
Then, and then either deep fried or pan fried. And I don't know, I usually associate black beans with potatoes, but I'm also looking not for the usual thing here. So,
well,
thinking, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about the stuff my mother used to do with leftover mashed potatoes, where she would chop into it Swiss chard or cooked spinach.
Okay.
She would brown up onions with garlic. She would often do sage with that, saute okay. The sage. And then she would mix that into the mashed potato. She always added a little bit of raw onion, and then she'd pan fry that. She'd dip it in egg and then dip it in breadcrumbs. Now, in the case of Hanukkah, you know, it could be matzah meal. I mean, it could be anything. It could be cornflakes.
Okay.
In fact, believe it or not, cornflakes are pretty good when you use them as a coating.
Yeah.
But you see the idea. And then you pan fry that. But you can make it very shallow patties. You know, they're very thin. A black bean could go into that.
That's true.
You know? Whole kernel corn could go into that.
Right.
Now, if you want to go the polenta route, you make the polenta even a couple of days ahead. Okay? Make it pretty stiff. I use a double boiler method for polenta.
All right.
Where I put boiling water and stir it into the polenta in a bowl sitting on top of a pot of boiling water. I cover the bowl with foil, and I let it go for about an hour and a half until it slowly swelled. Never make polenta fast.
Okay.
It is a barbarian's approach to making polenta.
That's a good thing, because I've had various degrees of success with polenta.
Yeah, so. You have to let it cook.
Okay.
It has to cook. So the point is, anyway, that once you have that, it solidifies, you slice it. Now, what you could do before you set it to cool is mix in fresh corn. And you could even use frozen corn, believe it or not. There are some frozen corns that are pretty swell. I'm not talking about the ones with sauces. But,
right.
You know, kernel corn, if you want corn. Uh-huh. Black beans could go in that, too.
All right.
And then
when that sets, then would you just then again bake it or broil it?
I would slice it and pan grill it.
Pan grill it. Okay.
Yeah. Rub it with a little olive oil and pan grill it and then sprinkle it with coarse salt.
Okay.
And slice it a little on the thin side. And then you have something very similar, minus the black beans, that I used to get at the market in Florence. And they look like playing cards that
mm-hmm.
had been grilled, the polenta, and it had fresh corn in it. And it was crunchy and crusty, and it was absolutely fabulous with the coarse salt. And you will have people kissing the hem of your apron.
That sounds great.
Absolutely. And by the way, don't forget a little tomato in there might be nice. You know, garlic, not a bad idea.
All right.
You're going to have a great Hanukkah.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
And have a great holiday.
Thanks.
Bye, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Call us 800-537-5252 or go to the website, splendidtable.org. We've got Susie on the line from Gambrills, Maryland. Susie, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I have a delightful dilemma that I hope you can help me with.
Yeah.
I have a staff of 7, and every year I take them out for lunch for the holidays. We're all public servants, but for the holidays I try to treat them well and do something sort of over the top and extravagant.
Right.
And the budget's usually around $300 or so, or that's what it's come in at.
You're a very generous boss.
once a year is okay. This year I asked them where they'd like to go so that we could get our reservations in early, and the unanimous vote was, we want you to cook for us.
I'm only laughing because it's the busiest time of year.
Oh, yes. And we just got a new puppy, so let's add that to the mix.
Oh, all right. Sure. Fine. Okay.
And in addition, I had had them over last summer and had done a barbecue for them, and I think that sort of tipped my hand. My question is, what can I fix for them? And I don't mind spending the money to do a nice meal, or not that I have to spend money for a nice meal, but I don't mind spending the money. There are no food limitations.
Right.
I'd love to prep as much ahead as possible. And one more zinger is, if there's something everybody could fix together at the last minute, that would be a lot of fun, too.
Ooh. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is let them fix the salad all together, because you could have a salad with a lot of things in it.
Lots of chopping.
Yeah, lots of chopping or sorting or whatever. So it might be that you have all ready to go some cooked green beans, and maybe, you know, it would almost be like a small salade niçoise. You could have some cooked potatoes that you ask somebody to do a little oil and vinegar with and slice it. And, hey, you know what would be fun?
Okay.
How about you do sort of a little like a salad centerpiece?
Ooh.
Where you have the greens, somebody goes and washes the greens, spins them in the salad spinner, mm-hmm. or whirls it over their head or whatever. And then you have cooked potatoes. They slice them, they dress them, that goes on a plate. You might have olives. The idea is all the components of a salad go out on the table. So mm-hmm. there may be nuts, there may be fruit, there may be some, you know, some kind of preserved meat or whatever. And it's all out there and everybody assembles their own. Everybody gets sort of a slightly oversized bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's worked to put that out, even if it's just arranging things.
And then it becomes a work of art for each of them.
Exactly. And then you maybe even have somebody create one dressing and somebody create another dressing.
Excellent.
And then I'm thinking, you know, this is what I always fall back on. When in doubt, you have to feed a lot of people a hunk of protein in the oven. But what I'm thinking is you want something you could have done a day or so ahead
mm-hmm.
and then rewarm. And that brings me to pot roast, but not the kind of pot roast most people think of. I'm thinking, what would happen if you took something like a pork shoulder and you cut into it so that you spiral into the center of it. So you can almost open it up like a sheet of paper,
mm-hmm.
you know, unroll
mm-hmm.
it like a jelly roll.
Yeah.
And then what you would put in there is garlic, a little bit of olive oil, some red wine, some raisins, some fresh thyme, some fresh rosemary, lemon peel, etc.
Okay.
Right? Salt, pepper, chopped up green herbs or parsley. All right. Were you with me?
I'm salivating.
Okay. You roll that baby up. You tie it with a few strings to hold it. You put it in the oven and you slow, slow roast it, basting it with wine. And you do that the night before.
Yes.
All right. You save all the pan juices. You mm-hmm. scrape them up with a little water or wine, you know, so you have the sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, what happens is that goes into a very deep pot. You pour in the pan juices and you rewarm it that way.
Mm.
And you could even rewarm it in the oven with the lid on.
Oh, my.
And then with that, you could have almost anything. I mean, you could do a wonder. You could do very simple shredded cabbage that you literally drop in hot water and remove and dress with sherry vinegar and a little bit of black pepper and salt, which would be really a great play against those flavors. And then you could have something like, you know, a big, you know, broccoli spears mm-hmm. that you lay out and you squeeze lots of fresh lemon over it. It's this whole idea of, you know, or some butter, the idea of keeping everything else really simple because the main event is all that stuff that's going on with the pork.
Oh, and I love pork.
And if you put some chutney or whatever out on the table, it would really be delicious too.
And maybe a nice earthy bread.
I don't think that could hurt. nor would a Rhone wine hurt either.
Oh, there's always room for a Rhone wine.
Exactly. So that's what my thinking is, the big hunk of protein, but fancy it up.
excellent. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a great party.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. Give us a call or go to the website, splendidtable.org. James in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, wants to know what to do with the various types of onion. Yellow, white, sweet, in quotes like Vidalia, green, scallion, etc. Okay, James, there's not a huge difference in flavor between the yellow onions, the white onions, and the red onions. Now, where the difference comes in is in those sweet onions, the Maui, the Walla Walla, the Vidalia, etc. Those onions are best eaten raw or maybe pickled. You know, put them in a little bit of vinegar with spices and that kind of thing and use them as a relish. I don't like to saute them because I think they just bland out. So those are the onions you want to use raw. Wonderful in salads. Absolutely delicious as a relish. In fact, you could even candy them, put them in sugar syrup. They're fabulous. As far as the scallions go, scallions are not just more delicate than an onion. They're a completely different animal. One of the things I love to do to scallions is treat them like a vegetable. Roll them in a little bit of olive oil, put some salt on them, run them under the broiler or cook them on the grill until they get really brown and they're softened and they're just delicious. You put that next to some crushed new potatoes that you've just poured a little bit of balsamic vinegar on. Not a bad thing at all. So there's your information, James, and thanks for a great question. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Call us, 800-537-5252. Pandeya, who's in Newton, Kansas, has a great question. And it's one of those things, you know, everybody wonders about, but you don't ask it. She says, almost every baking recipe says to use the middle rack of the oven, but every oven she's ever used has four positions for the rack, so there's no middle. So which one should she use? This is what I've always done. I use the second rack from the bottom, and that usually places whatever I'm baking more or less in the middle. So not to be too picky, but use the second rack from the bottom. You'll get great air circulation and heat circulation around whatever you're doing, which is the point of the whole deal. And thanks for a great question. Zoe's on the phone from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Zoe, good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Lynn.
So what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fruitcake for Christmas.
A brave soul you are.
I know it. So brave, I don't know where to start.
Okay. Have you ever done one before?
I have not.
Okay. There's going to be a couple of great recipes out there in the world. You could check our website, splendidtable.org. Epicurious is another good website because Epicurious, most of it's a collection of recipes from Bon Appetit and Gourmet magazine, and
okay,
they test recipes up the kazoo. You want to be careful of a lot of sites that have a million recipes because you don't know if they've really been tested by professionals to make sure that they're worth your time.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, what kind of fruitcake you want to make? The classic old, you know, style fruitcake?
You know, I'm up for that. I'm up for something maybe a little more modern. I think the biggest thing I want to avoid is that kind of weird candied fruit taste. I like candied fruit just fine, but I guess I just want to make sure if that's the fruit I need to pick, fine, but what do I add to make it taste really good? Once upon a time, I had great fruitcake.
Do you remember what it was like?
You know, it's been so long. I just know it was good.
To try something that probably no one has tasted on this side of the Atlantic ever?
Sure.
It's from Italy, and the original recipe goes back to somewhere around the 1600s. Mm. And I think we've got it on the website. It's a recipe from my first book. And in my first book, I wrote a lot about the Renaissance in northern Italy in a particular region. And it is a chocolate fruitcake.
Oh, wow.
It's a chocolate Christmas cake, really, and it's more cake or almost bread than it is fruit. It has candied citron in it,
okay,
chunks of chocolate, and it has a thin slick of melted chocolate over the top. It's not wildly sweet, and one recipe makes a couple of small loaves so mm-hmm. that, you know, you can actually, and they're little domes, you know, they're freehand. And you can, they're great for giving as gifts.
Oh, that's perfect.
Now, it's that's called, there's two, I can't remember the exact name I've got on the website, but the Italian name is Pan Pepato, P-A-N-P-E-T-A-T-O, and it means pepper bread. Because the early spice cakes and you know, fruit cakes were usually dried fruits or candied fruits or both with spices in them and often pepper because those were some very expensive and very precious things. Mm. People didn't have mm-hmm. them, you know, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So they made them at this special time of year. But check out on the website Pan Pepato or Ferrara Christmas Cake or Chocolate Christmas Cake. Yeah, and it's mainly, it's chocolate, it's not super sweet, and it's mm-hmm. really lovely, and it has candied citron. And if you want to throw dried apricots into it, dried peaches cut in small mm. pieces, that mm-hmm. kind of thing, it would do it no harm whatsoever.
That sounds fantastic.
I think you'll like it, and it's something yeah. unusual. People will not have had it, and it's delicious if you have it with a glass of port at the end of the meal or just coffee. But,
sure.
it, you know, it's really tasty. So, enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you. I finally got to sit at the grown-ups table last year. I'm almost 40, and I think if you could bring something fantastic, it would secure my spot there for a long time.
I know the feeling very well. I know it very well. Well, Merry Christmas, Zoe.
Thank you. The same to you, Lynn.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
This Pan Pepato, it's a wonderful recipe. And it's from my first book, The Splendid Table. And what I love about it is it's like making mud pies. You do it by hand. It's just, you mush things together, you pat it into these little loaves, you bake it off, and you're done. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Dr. Spock, who said, "Trust yourself. You know more than you think you do." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, we're doing something important here at The Splendid Table this month. We're partnering with Feeding America to bring assistance to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table this holiday season, your gift will not only help us produce our program, but will help provide meals to people in need through Feeding America's network of member food banks. In these months of feasting and celebration for many of us, let's remember those who are going without. Visit splendidtable.org to get more information on our partnership with Feeding America, as well as information on anything else you heard here today. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.